For over 30 years, BHM has been the trusted CPA firm for closely held businesses across Ohio and West Virginia.
BHM has made life easier for myself and our company when it comes to tax and accounting.
At BHM, we develop top talent to tackle your most complex challenges.
A CPA firm can be the lifeblood to a successful business. If you don't feel that way about your firm, ask yourself why not.
Visit bhmcpagroup.com to schedule a consultation. BHM, the CPA firm simplifying the complex.
And I think I would go crazy if I just had to do the political stuff.
I tell people that a lot, where they say to me, like, what can I do to feel different and better? I'm like, shut off the TV, get off social media, take Twitter off your phone.
That's right.
Have a thing in the real world. Even though the world may be on fire, have a thing in the real world that you do that you love.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, it's Rick Wilson. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. As always, I am your host, and I'm joined today by a very fascinating guy. Alex Gibney is one of the most prolific and insightful documentary filmmakers out there today. And I wanted to talk to Alex today not only about where he sees the role of filmmaking and narrative, because we work in different formats. He works in the longer explanatory format. We work in the shorter punch in the face format. But a lot of the stuff that Alex has dug into, it's politics, it's culture. It's an approach to looking at our moments that we're in this chaotic era. That I find really compelling. And I wanted to talk to you first, Alex, about your newest project, which is the BB Files, your most recent project. Because as somebody who was working on some Israeli politics a few years ago, while this was happening with Netanyahu, there was a sprawling corruption trial, which I'll let Alex talk about here. There was an expectation inside Israeli politics was, we got him now, can't escape this one, and yet he did. Alex, talk to us about the BB Files and about this remarkable footage that you were sent, and walk us through where Netanyahu stood then and where he stands now in terms of being the ultimate political survivor.
Sure. Well, the BB Files is a film that I produced and is directed by a woman named Alexis Bloom, a longtime colleague of mm-hmm. mine. The whole thing started when I got a message on Signal from somebody who said, I've got some material I think you'll really be interested in. Now, I get those messages from time to time. And usually they don't amount to much. However, in this case, I pulled at the thread, and lo and behold, what the source had was about 1,000 hours of police interrogation videos mm-hmm. related to the Benjamin Netanyahu corruption case. And that they included interviews with Netanyahu, Netanyahu's wife, Sarah, his son Yair, yep. as well as a whole host of Israeli officials. Mm-hmm. And this is a corruption case that related to how he was using his office for personal yep. Enrichment. Mm-hmm. Pure and simple. And sometimes they related to things like very expensive champagne, very expensive cigars, jewelry for Sarah. And in other cases, they represented trading enormous regulatory favors to people who could help Netanyahu right. Burnish his image in the media. Mm-hmm. So that was a kind of the essence of the case. And so when we got this material, which was really extraordinary, and also showed Netanyahu in a light that was considerably more venal than the image of the grand statesman that he likes to project,
sure.
it seemed a project well worth taking on. Mind you, I got this material in March or so of 2023. This was right. prior to 10/7.
Yeah.
So when 10/7 happened, we took a pause and wondered exactly how this would reckon with our project. Over time, we invested into a narrative that really related to Netanyahu's unbelievably assiduous attempts to avoid a legal reckoning, and in so doing, to engage the Middle East in a kind of forever war. That became, well, it's the conclusion of the film, but it's based on the testimony from former Shin Bet officers and former diplomats and so forth and so on, that what Netanyahu is doing is he keeps wrapping himself in the mantle of the person who's protecting the security of Israel, even though we make a point that he was the one who had funded or allowed for the funding of Hamas in order to destabilize, you know, the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank. That's the essence of the film. It's really about how a guy is desperately trying to avoid a legal reckoning and to cling to power no matter what, and the consequences mm-hmm. are horrific.
You know, it's funny because I talked to someone who, former Israeli intelligence person, now a pretty significant business leader in the country, who after October 7th just said, he was very cynical about it, and he said he was at his home in California. It lives half the year in Israel, part of the year in California. And he goes, I'm going to tell you, he goes, the saddest thing about this is, I promise you, Bibi will have known all about this. Right. He will have known this was coming. There would have been intelligence indicators. He goes, and he goes, I've known him for 40 years. He will absolutely have known this was coming. And nothing could have been better for him in the timing of his trials, of his political moment. And it's interesting because there is a Trumpian nature to Bibi, I think, that has been sort of underplayed. I think you're right. He's always playing the role of protector of the country, but he's always generating some of the chaos that he then pretends to have to protect people from.
Yes, and I think the Trumpian parallels are enormous. Also, the parallel of trying to avoid a legal reckoning, and that is what propels the political project. And also personal enrichment. And a tendency toward authoritarian rule, and forming alliances with, in Bibi's case, with extreme right-wing forces in order to be able to stay in power.
Yeah, that's always been the sort of I think, air gap that Americans don't understand Israeli politics, is the presence of all these hard-right religious micro-parties that make up parts of the coalition that he's able to keep pasting together over time. And aside from a brief little moment there, he's been in power now for how many years? It's like 30 years almost, or something like that.
Yeah, 17, I think, all told. But
yeah, but, right, that's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. But he is, you know, I just think this is such an important film because we are in this moment where Trump is proposing something that I think even Netanyahu, and you know, he's got a good poker face, but even he, when Trump said, oh, we're going to take over Gaza and we're going to pave it, turn it into a resort.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip and we will do a job with it too. We'll own it.
Even Netanyahu had a moment where there was a couple of tells. Like, he looked down at the podium because I don't think even he expected that one to pop up.
No. I think it popped up in the moment. I mean, obviously, you know, rattling in Trump's head was the chit chat from Jared Kushner about mm-hmm. like what a great location this is, real estate, location, location, location. So you know, he, without any sense of consequence, it pops up into his head. Yeah, sure, we'll clean it out, get all those people out of there, right. We'll build it up into a really nice place. It'll look like Trump Tower.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to talk a little bit about like the topicality of the doc stuff that you do, because it always seems it looks like you have a fairly aggressive like event to production window that unlike some documentary filmmakers who work over these long haul stretches. I mean, you've done stuff contemporaneously about Russian interference in 2016, the COVID crisis. You know, what is it that, how do you make a selection? What does your creative like instinct lead you to when you see a big event coming right, you know, ahead of us? How do you pick the topics that you're going to make a doc on?
Well, sometimes they pick me, but and I would draw a distinction between the COVID film that you cited, which was called Totally Under Control, really about Trump's handling of the COVID crisis. You know, that was one that was by intent rushed through production extremely fast.
Right.
I think, you know, it took us all of 3 months to make that film. And we were making it during COVID. So
right.
it had to be done with all of these kind of COVID restrictions.
Right. There was a lot of remote stuff in that.
That's right. That's right. With plastic sheeting and, you know, we had a COVID cam, which we literally delivered to people's doors, you know, so that there, no human interface would happen. We would take it, they would turn it on, and then we would talk to them remotely. That was a bit different. You know, to be honest, usually the films that I take on have something to do with the current moment, but are also designed to stand the test of time.
Sure.
I mean, the Netanyahu film was about corruption. And indeed, we took it on without knowing that there was going to be this kind of a 10-7 attack or the kind of carnage in Gaza that was ultimately going to happen. We were interested at the time in what was going on in terms of the protests over Netanyahu's attempts to sort of capture the judiciary, another parallel with Trump.
So
I think that generally speaking, there's a kind of rough sense of the zeitgeist that I have, but truth be told, my projects tend to take, you know, a year or more in the making. But we're always attentive to events, and even in the cutting room, the films are changing as events change. So
sure,
it's a tricky balance.
I think the first time I sort of thought, oh, that's Alex Gibney. Was on Going Clear on Scientology. You've handled a lot of controversial subjects. Where were they on the scale of difficulty to deal with? Because I've heard so many stories of people who cross Scientology, whether it's in writing, whether it's journalism or books or documentaries, where the pressure campaign there feels like it's coming from a nation state.
Yeah, well, they had a reputation of being bullies and in some cases going after journalists very hard.
Sure.
So much so that they would literally drive them insane. And they had launched, I believe, the biggest media lawsuit in history against Time Inc.
Right.
But that then gave them cred. So they could always threaten to sue and people would generally back down. It was interesting you mentioned Scientology because they were tough adversaries and they did come after me in a number of ways. Me and Lawrence Wright, who was the author of the book Going Clear. Mm-hmm. But what Mike Rinder, who recently passed away, who's kind of the head of PR or really attack PR for Scientology, told me early on in the project. He said, Alex, they're going to try to get inside your head. Don't let them. In other words, they create a scenario whereby you think there's a Scientologist on every corner. There really isn't, but they do create that impression, and they go to great lengths to try to make that happen. So that's really it. I mean, they threatened to sue, but they never did sue. Obviously, whenever you sue, you open yourself up to discovery.
Right, and that's the last thing they want to play.
That's right.
So you do a fair number of things in politics and in looking at the things that are affecting the political and national culture, and you also touch on sports fairly frequently
I enjoy that. Yeah, I enjoy that. I you know, there's a friend of mine, a guy you would know, David Halberstam.
Of course, yeah.
Now, way. And David, you know, had a rhythm to his book career, which was he would always do the big book, the best, the brightest, the reckoning. And he'd always juxtapose that with a sports book, the breaks of the game, the amateurs, so forth and so on. I love that idea. And so, you know, in between the political stuff, I do sports docs and also music docs. I really enjoy them a lot. And I invest a great deal of my time. And I think I would go crazy if I just had to do the political stuff.
I tell people that a lot, where they say to me, like, what can I do to feel different and better? I'm like, shut off the TV, get off social media, take Twitter off your phone.
That's right.
Have a thing in the real world. Even though we are in a, even though the world may be on fire, have a thing in the real world that you do that you love.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show.
Or that demands your focus, that demands your attention. I think that's a work balance instead of a work life balance question. By the way, you mentioned Lawrence, right? I want to loop back on one thing. I thought that the Looming Tower series you guys did, based on Lawrence's unbelievably terrific book about the origin story of Al Qaeda, I thought that was terrific. I thought that was what did you guys do, 2018, somewhere in there?
Yeah, I think it was like 2018 or 2019.
Okay.
It was definitely pre-COVID.
Yeah, and it just, I remember watching it at the time and I was like, you know, this story would have contextualized a lot of things. And I wish more of my Republican colleagues had read Looming Tower back in the beginning of the war rather than at the end of the war. Because by the time you guys put that series out, it was basically, we were in the very tail end of all the active part of it after all the damage had been sort of cooked into the system. So what are you looking forward to doing next, Alex?
Well, weirdly, I mean, you talk about how being on top of the news. I mean, I've just finished two films for HBO about the role of money in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't be more
on point for right now.
And for the last 2 years, I've also been working on a documentary on Elon Musk.
So let's talk about that a little bit, and not to do spoilers. You know, he is a guy who, if Americans knew who he was 3 years ago, it was Tesla guy, PayPal guy, yeah. Rocket guy.
Are
the things that you're learning in that film or learned during that consonant with what you're seeing now, or has he reached a new level of drunk on power that we just haven't understood before?
First of all, I should preface this by saying I'm still working on the film. So what I have to say is kind of like general
sure.
point of view from the standpoint of what I'm seeing so far, mm-hmm. and what research has led me to understand to this point. So still working, and obviously the story is ongoing. But here's what I would say. I say that this present moment, a lot can be understood within the context of past as prologue.
Sure.
In other words, a lot of the patterns that you see now are patterns that he engaged in rather recklessly, I would say, over the course of his career. I mean, it is true that Tesla is an extraordinarily valuable company,
mm-hmm.
but it's mostly valuable because of the enormous, the high level of its stock price,
right.
which exceeds all other car companies in the world combined.
Right.
But I would argue not so potent when it comes to economic fundamentals.
Sure.
And
oh,
indeed,
no, yeah.
has a lot of serious problems. But if you look at his career over time, and then so at Tesla, he became famous for firing people summarily all mm-hmm. the time, but not necessarily in a good way. That's the one thing he, by the way, shares with Donald Trump. You're fired, right?
Right.
And to some extent, everybody, you know, hunkers down and says, yeah, he's a tough businessman and he's going to fire people and that's good. Well, it's not always good. If you fire all the air traffic controllers at O'Hare at the same time, that's not a good outcome.
No, that's going to turn bad quick.
Right. So I think that's one of the things. And obviously, the other thing one needs to know is that the success of Tesla, to a great extent, was due to reward hacking by getting money from the federal government.
That's
a lot of what people don't really properly understand, both in the form of loans, subsidies, carbon credits. Correct. Without those, Tesla doesn't really make its first profit, and it would be an even more marginally profitable company than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So that needs to be understood. And then when you get into something like Twitter, which was bought more or less on a whim,
right?
And also he goes in and applies the same kind of human resources strategy that he's now applying to the federal government, which is to say, fire everybody. In other words, take a percentage. Mm-hmm. Let's fire 75% of the people. What could possibly go wrong, right? And you know, people forget, but Twitter lost, I believe it was 80% of its value,
right,
from the moment that Musk bought it to. It's a little bit different now because the value of all his companies has increased enormously because he's back in the pocket. And the pocket is he has a pipeline to the federal treasury right now.
Oh, yes.
And so as a result, if you're a money person, you realize, oh, well, you know, the president of the United States is giving him almost unlimited power and opening up the bank account to him. So that's a good investment, but it's an investment, you know, sort of like you would invest in Al Capone, Chicago.
Right, right. I had a Silicon Valley person tell me about a year and a half ago. He didn't really predict Elon jumping into bed with Trump as aggressively, but he said, if Trump wins again, Elon will be in terrific shape to be able to say, when I take SpaceX public, which it is, that will be an extraordinarily valuable company, dwarfing the rest, dwarfing Twitter and Tesla, that there would be a lot of people who would handle him with kid gloves in the financial markets and the political markets to get into that deal, to get into SpaceX's IPO. And I think there's something about Musk that with me, that he's a great operator, a manipulator of the financial side of the equation more than a technologist or an engineer.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show.
I think what he is a bullshitter, but a very, very good one. I mean, that's his strength.
Right.
You know, that he spins a story. Because Tesla is a classic example. The only reason that Tesla's stock is where it is that people somehow believe, almost in a religious context, that because Elon is a genius, another thing which I think is way overblown, mm-hmm. that somehow he's going to take that company to some mythical promised land that has no basis as yet in reality. So I think his ability to weave a story about himself is very powerful. That may be his greatest skill, that and a high tolerance for risk. But I the other thing that relates to both Trump and also Bibi, which is interesting in this moment, is that if you want to look for the turn, and people are always looking for the political turn, was it the woke mind virus? Is that why he became so pro-MAGA? And I think the reason had something more to do with the fact that both in terms of regulatory actions against this company and also criminal investigations into himself, he was facing possible prison time, and also an enormous number of, adverse consequences to all of his companies. So by throwing his weight behind Trump, he who's only interested in personal loyalty, he can now end all of those investigations.
Sure.
It's good. I mean, it's bad.
Yeah, the SEC slate will be wiped clean if it hasn't been already.
It's more than the SEC slate, right. But yes, the SEC investigation was one. It was a criminal investigation.
That was what I said. That was the one I think that probably would have worried his attorneys the most because of the criminal liability there.
That's right.
You covered you did a doc about another sort of Silicon Valley hustler,
Elizabeth Holmes
Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos. Yeah. My favorite story about that was a friend of mine was at Sun Valley and Rupert was on a golf cart with her, and someone asked Rupert, like, who was that? He goes, I have no fucking idea, but I want to do a, but I'm going to give a $25 million, some kind of company with blood.
Well, this is the thing that always floors me. Like, you know, we think, or we're taught that when it comes to business, there is an extraordinarily rigorous scientific process that goes into the calculation of risk and reward. Basically, a bunch of rich people sitting around saying, yeah, okay, I'll give you $1 billion. Sure, what the fuck? And and that was certainly the case with Elizabeth Holmes. She had spun a story to people that people wanted to believe in, and that was enough. I mean, I can't remember now precisely how much Murdoch invested.
I think it was 20 or 25. It was not.
No, it was more than that. Oh, okay. It was over $100 million.
It was certainly not nothing.
It was not nothing.
But I wonder sometimes, like, how much of the Silicon Valley stuff that we see these companies that are the thing and they disappear. How many more Musks and Holmeses are out there? And I wonder sometimes, you know, maybe I think the AI bubble is probably creating a lot of those people right now that we will eventually see them, you know, crash and burn. But
yeah,
that strikes me as like a not to tell you your business, but that strikes me as a storyline about this new gilded age of American money, where big part of it is based on bullshit.
Yeah, it's based on speculation. I mean, and that's why there's such an obsession by Musk, for example, in terms of being known as the founder of Tesla, which he's not.
Or SpaceX, for that matter.
Or SpaceX, correct. But the founders get the cash, right? You get the best stock position. And let's also remember that he was tossed out of his first two companies.
Mm-hmm.
But only in Silicon Valley. It's not if you're a policeman or a fireman or a nurse, you know, if you get tossed out, you don't fail up. They don't give you a big bucket of cash on your way out to do it.
Right.
But in Silicon Valley, that's apparently the way it works.
Yeah, you don't get punished. You get
rewarded.
You get a very beautiful golden parachute, and you get he's an innovator, and it just I think you're right, that idea of rigor in business is culturally in people's heads, that there is some sort of seriousness and consistency and structure in corporate America that it may exist in parts of it still. But there is a sort of, I mean, Silicon Valley is the Wild West. And frankly, a lot of private equity now is also the Wild West, where they are they are buying everything they believe to be monetizable in the end and trying to race for the finish line. But so, Alex, let me ask you this. I know we're getting short on time here. What is it that your career in making these documentary films has taught you about the American character?
I mean, that's a big question. You know, most of the films that I do have to do with power and abuse of power. And one of the things I've learned about that is something an old political science professor used to tell me, which is that economic actors are not rational, they're rationalizers, which is a way of saying that usually behind every great crime is some kind of mission that allows the perp to sleep well at night. And so there's a kind of grand vision that is there to hide the malfeasance. So that's one thing I've learned. The other thing I've learned about the American character, and this is something I actually learned more from Hunter Thompson, who I also did a film about, was that the American character is both very admirable and idealistic and also very dark. In America, we have the extremes. The enormous sense of possibility and promise and a kind of murderous instinct that doesn't want to be chained by any restraint. That, I think, is something that and the country tends to swing between these poles. So that's one thing I've learned about the American character.
Well, it is you have a fascinating life because you're able to tell these stories. I mean, it swings some between fiction and documentary stuff, but that I think are always relevant to the moment. I always enjoy your work. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast today. And anything else folks need to know? Anything where they should follow you on social media or any other projects you want to
follow me on social media? I'm still on X.
I call it Twitter still.
And also on Blue Sky.
Excellent.
And the BB Files you can watch on jolt.film.
Nice.
It wasn't on a regular streamer, but it's there for you to see.
All right. Folks, thanks again, Alex, for coming on. Folks, we'll see you again on the next episode of the Lincoln Project Podcast.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production.
Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe,
and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Produced by Whitney Hayes.
Edited by Riley Main.
Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.